Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Chaos rules in Congress as the U.S. marks the second anniversary of the January 6th attacks. I'm joined by Robert Draper, who's been covering the Washington waiting game, and former Democratic Congressman Mondaire Jones. Then, the fighting continues in Ukraine after Kyiv dismisses Putin's ceasefire. The latest with independent Russian journalist Mikhail Zigar and American reporter Luke Mogelson, who spent time on the Ukrainian front lines. Also ahead,
this is a very strong, flashing, don't panic sign.
The president of the Eurasia Group, Ian Bremmer, hails the resilience of the world's democracies, but warns our Walter Isaacson that global challenges lie ahead in 2023.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Goldriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour. The United States is marking the second anniversary of the attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. It is a solemn occasion that President Biden is marking by awarding the Presidential Citizens Medal to 12 individuals who have defended U.S. democracy. Many of them are Capitol Police who faced the rioters 2 years ago. Meantime, Congress faces a new crisis as well, the kind that has not been seen in 164 years. After 3 days, the House of Representatives remains speakerless as the Republican majority struggles to overcome bitter divides. Their leader, Kevin McCarthy, is trading away more and more power to garner the support of stubborn holdouts. But even if the strategy pays off, what he's giving away could make Congress almost unmanageable. Well, there's a lot to talk about, so let's get right to it. I'm joined by Mondaire Jones, former Democratic congressman who was at the Capitol during the attack 2 years ago. And also with us is Robert Draper. He's the author of Weapons of Mass Delusion, When the Republican Party Lost Its Mind, and has been reporting from the Capitol all week. Welcome, both of you. Robert, let me start with you. So going into today's session, Kevin McCarthy said that he expects holdouts voting for him today, that some of those 20 will in fact turn. And that is what we saw in the first voting session of the day. Obviously, a better day for Kevin McCarthy than it has been in the days prior, but that is all relative. What do you expect to happen at the end of the day? Will he solidify leadership?
Well, I don't know yet if it's going to happen by the end of the day, Bianca. It's certainly going to happen soon. I think that McCarthy faces a couple of problems in the immediate. Obviously, he's chipping away at votes, but there's going to be a hard core that will still prevent him from getting the speakership, and he's got to figure out a way to build some kind of off-ramp for them, because some of them who are in this, like Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert, I do not think are in it because they really want to change procedure. They're in it for the fight club, and there is a base that rewards that kind of fighting behavior. The converse of that is that if they do give in, even if there's a very suitable compromise to them, it's still going to look like capitulation. So they'll have to figure that out. The second more long-term concern is the one that you referenced earlier, Bianca, which is that this is going to make for an extremely weak speakership. And it is going to be very, very difficult to see how already with a razor-thin majority of 222 or so, it's going to be hard to get to 218 on anything. But now it's going to be difficult just to decide on what bills get moved into committee, what rules govern floor activity. It's going to be a real mess.
Yeah, a mess indeed. It already is a real mess. But let's talk about some of the concessions that McCarthy has already made to no avail at this point. And that is allowing one member to vote to oust the speaker, a 72-hour rule to review bills, more Freedom Caucus members be placed on the rules committees. And just today, Bloomberg is reporting that he agreed to $75 billion in defense cuts. I'm just curious, given these concessions, what impact do you think that would have on his speakership if he does, in fact, gain it at some point? And could we be here again, given some of these concessions, in just a week or two's time?
And the answer is yes. It could mean for not only a weak speakership, but a very, very short-term one. I think that, you know, the idea of a snap vote, a motion to vacate, has been present for some time. It was Speaker Pelosi who changed the rule on that after it had happened to Boehner. The problem, of course, is that this is a very rambunctious, arguably ungovernable, unmanageable group of Republicans who will chomp at the bit for the possibility to do this. I think that, some of the other changes were arguably welcome amongst mainstream Republicans, even including allowing, say, more Freedom Caucus types to be on the Rules Committee. But the motion to vacate is, you know, essentially a—I mean, it could augur a very, very short speakership for McCarthy.
Yeah, some of these proposals, one could argue, are legitimate. Some are just to blow the system up as a whole. Mondaer, as we said, we haven't seen something like this take place in 164 years. I'm just wondering, given your perch, you are now not in Congress, but you were, and you were there 2 years ago, and we're going to talk about the meaning and the symbolism of all this happening today. What is your take on the issue at hand and how Democrats are responding in unison right now, just watching this from the sidelines?
Well, this is extraordinary, as you noted. The fact that the only precedence for this is, or was, the years leading up to the Civil War, I think, is telling in and of itself. I was listening to my former colleague Joe Neguse in nominating Hakeem Jeffries as minority leader, or as speaker, I should say, on the House floor yesterday. He talked about being sworn in January of 2019 in the midst of a government shutdown. He talked about being sworn in January of 2021 alongside folks like myself. And of course, just a few days later, we saw an attempted coup, the overthrow of the federal government itself, incited by the leader of the Republican Party, Donald Trump. And so this is, in some ways, the natural progression of a party, a Republican Party, that increasingly is filled with people who do not want to govern, but rather who want to incite anger among the American people. And when they finally do elect a speaker, which I do believe will happen, I don't know that it will be Kevin McCarthy, but it will be somebody. What will happen next? They're going to be investigating Hunter Biden and, you know, giving a lot of money to other investigations that the American people did not elect them to do, and that are distractions from the issues of inflation and crime and immigration and the other things that they ran on.
Mondaer, I want you to respond to what Congressman Matt Rosendale, who is opposed to McCarthy's speakership, said in terms of his concern about the consolidation of power that's held and wielded by the speaker and has been for years. This has been an issue that has been raised, let's be fair, by Democrats as well in the past. And again, putting aside those who are just doing this for chaos's sake, I'm wondering if you think he has a point when he says this. Let's play.
The debate and the discussion has been all but eliminated, and the balance of us are left to vote yes or no. Those are our options, and that is what has led to the disintegration of the relationships that we see across this floor. So yes, we need to have change. We need to fix this broken system.
Mondaer, do you agree with him? Does change need to be seen? And is the system broken?
Some of these concessions that members of the Freedom Caucus have obtained have merit. So you talk about having 72 hours notice before voting on the bill on the floor of the House. You talk about making sure that there is representation across the ideological spectrum on committees. But here's the thing. Members of the Freedom Caucus are not committed to governing. And so when you put them on the Rules Committee, that is a recipe for disaster. And the most alarming of the concessions thus far has been this motion to vacate the chair. That means, at least as of recent reporting, that at least that only one person is required to have a vote on replacing Kevin McCarthy, for example. And that is going to mean that he is going to have a short-lived speakership, because you can easily find a small number of Republicans, including the ones who have been voting for someone other than Kevin McCarthy this week, to align themselves with Democrats who would be thrilled to replace Kevin McCarthy, who, by the way, is not nearly as moderate as many people in the press have been describing him as. He's just more moderate than the extreme far right that is now voting against him.
You know, people like Matt Gaetz threatened that he would just resign if anybody from his party worked with Democrats. So we'll see if that does end up transpiring at some points in terms of nominating somebody there for speakership. Robert, as we noted, today is a solemn day. It marks the 2-year mark of the attack at the Capitol. And not all of these 200 that are behind McCarthy are election deniers, but a good portion are. And of the 20 that are the holdouts, I believe all of them are election deniers. So yes, we can say 2 years later, democracy prevailed. But I'm just wondering, given that these 20, at least, maybe the number's gone down a bit now, are holding this process hostage, what does this say about the threat to democracy going forward in our capital, in our government?
Sure. Bianca, I just want to say that 2 years ago, at precisely this time, I was walking through the Capitol Rotunda and happened to see on my left some Capitol policemen running up the steps of the West Terrace. I went over there and before, in a matter of minutes, found myself being among an ad hoc group that was helping to set up a water station so that the police could remove the mace from their eyes. It was a really, really horrific day. And it was interesting to see in the last couple of days when Democrats have stood up and denounced the Republicans for their behavior on January the 6th, to see no effort at rebuttal on their part. And I do think that to your point that the 20 holdouts are all election deniers, one thing that we can certainly see is far from any kind of repair or self-repudiation about what they did and didn't do that day. We will instead likely see among the investigations that takes place the investigation of the January 6th committee itself, that they will be burrowing through the evidence boxes to see if there's anything to suggest, for example, if Speaker Nancy Pelosi had played some role in the laxness of the security. That is certainly a conclusion that a lot of these Republicans have reached, and now they're going to try to find evidence to support that conclusion.
Mondaire, at some point, listen, I understand the message being sent by Democrats now that their House is in order and they have continued to nominate Hakeem Jeffries as their speaker and their leader. But at some point, they were elected by the American public and voters to get things done in Washington. And at some point, I don't know how long this is going to last, but even once a speaker is announced, they've got to deal with real serious issues like the debt ceiling, like funding for Ukraine, funding the government, et cetera. Is there a point where they're missing an opportunity by not stepping in, by not appealing or appearing to look like they are willing to work across the aisle for the sake of the country as a whole?
In fact, I think you see Democrats doing that every time there is a ballot cast and Hakeem Jeffries is the highest vote getter by a large margin. It is the natural next step for any so-called moderate Republican of good conscience who cares about governing to go over to Democrats who are unified and say, hey, there are about five of us who are willing to vote for a Democratic leader. And no one, by the way, has, from my observation, been critical of Hakeem Jeffries as someone who would be a good speaker among those moderate Republicans who've been speaking to the press. And of course, they can negotiate the terms of a power sharing agreement. But it is not a natural next step, I think, for Democrats who are unified and who have been nominating someone who's getting more votes consistently to go over to the other side and empower a Kevin McCarthy, for example, who was one of the 2/3 of House Republicans in January of 2021 to vote to overturn that free and fair presidential election. This is the problem. It's not just the first order of business of electing a Republican speaker, it's what happens afterwards when they're in the majority. The investigations, the inability to deal with the debt ceiling because they're not serious about making policy. It's why they're better oftentimes at running for office than in actually governing. And I think so long as the American people continue to see what is happening, they are going to come away with a better understanding of what happens when you put Republicans in charge of government.
Robert, as we close here, what impact at all does this have on the Biden presidency? You couldn't help but notice, you know, trying to juxtapose the two images, one you see happening at the Capitol and one earlier this week where Biden was touting bipartisanship, going to Kentucky at a bridge there with Mitch McConnell. He seems to still be supportive and believes in the notion of working across the aisle, even though that doesn't appear to be what we see taking place in reality there. We can't even get a speakership announced. What do you make of the implications on him?
Well, sure. I think that, you know, the silver lining for Biden and the Democrats and the Democrats losing control over the House is that the Republicans now are in control of the House and with this majority of five or so. And so the Biden administration, while doing other things, will certainly take every opportunity to contrast their own performance and their own efforts at good governance with the chaos that presumably will surround Kevin McCarthy's Republicans. This will be the reminder that if you allow the American voter, if you allow Republicans to run the table, to control the Senate, the House, and the executive branch, then you will see this pervasive dysfunctionality. And so I think that we're going to be hearing that message from the Biden administration over and over again, using the Republican-controlled House as a foil, basically, to their own efforts.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Robert Draper, Mondaire Jones, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time. Hopefully at some point, whether today or this weekend, we can announce to our viewers that there is, in fact, a speaker in the United States Congress. But as of yet, we will continue to wait and watch. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Cynical. That is how Kyiv and Washington are describing Russia's declaration of a temporary ceasefire to coincide with an Orthodox Christmas. Ukraine has not agreed to it, and CNN today witnessed incoming and outgoing artillery fire around the eastern city of Bakhmut. Meanwhile, new pictures show the devastation caused by months of heavy fighting in that city. Two guests join me now for a look at power dynamics in Moscow and life on the battlefield in Ukraine. Mikhail Zigar is an independent Russian journalist and author of All the Kremlin's Men, now living in exile in Berlin. And New Yorker writer Luke Mogelson is among the few people to have spent time embedded with fighters during this war, and he joins us from Paris. Welcome, both of you. Misha, if I can start with you, there is some healthy skepticism over the motivation of Putin's unilateral move for a Christmastime ceasefire, as we are hearing sirens in the cities throughout Ukraine as well. There is an idea, perhaps, that he's doing this to buy more time and perhaps even conscript more Russian men. What is your take on this?
No, I personally think that that's some completely internal propaganda, and that message is directed to Russian audience, like all the people who are watching Russian television at home, because there is still New Year's holidays going on, and they are watching it, and they hear that Putin is the only person who wants peace, and they might be satisfied with that message. And that's they are the target of that message, not Ukraine, not the United States.
So the target is his own people there through propaganda. Luke, you, as we noted, are one of the few journalists who was able to embed with fighters in this war. And you have a fascinating piece where you talk about the legion of fighters from around the world that have joined Ukrainian troops there on the ground. And you've spent time with them. And you talk about over the course of the months, the numbers start to dwindle as the fighting becomes more and more intensified and real. You talk about people who remain, like TQ, Turtle, Herring. Tell us a little bit about these men who you got to know and meet and their stories.
Well, these were members of the International Legion, which was created at the very beginning of the war to accommodate foreign veterans of other wars that wanted to help defend Ukraine against the Russian invasion. And as you mentioned, there was an initial significant influx of volunteers from as many as 52 different countries. But that quickly changed when they encountered the very brutal reality of combat in Ukraine, which I think was unlike anything that even veterans of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria had experienced previously. So the number of fighters there now is much smaller, but they are all committed and serious and professional fighters, such as the five men I spent time with in Donetsk.
Yeah, we're showing images from your time with them as we speak. You also got to know an American who went by the name of Doc Herring, also an American. Doc was a former tech industry expert, at one time worked for Google. All of these men brought their own experiences and training to the battlefield there. And I want to read from your piece about Herring. And you write about Herring in 2018 had brought a drone and taught himself to locate schools of fish by tracking the whales and sharks that fed on them. When he realized the drones would play a role in Ukraine, he said it was hard to sit on the sidelines knowing you could help. He added that he had grown up in Illinois, and as a Midwesterner, dude, I always hated Russia, the whole Red Dawn thing. Herring had flown drones for hundreds of hours in Donetsk, dropping explosives on Russian positions and identifying enemy coordinates for Ukrainian artillery. I know you got an update on his well-being. He had been injured, but he is back fighting. What have men like Herring and Doc contributed to this war with their own skill set?
Well, this particular group that I was with specialized in reconnaissance. So they were going out mostly at night to probe the no man's land or the gray zone in between the Russian and Ukrainian lines, which is extremely dangerous and risky and does require a certain specialized skill set and as well as special equipment such as night vision goggles and thermal scopes, and Herring was operating a drone that had a thermal camera that could detect the heat signatures of Russian tanks and soldiers.
Yeah, and one more tidbit about their interactions with Ukrainian troops that I found was so interesting was how they communicated with each other. You know, in 2022, 23, we talk about this war and the trench warfare looking a lot like World War I. Well, even the language barriers got in the way as well. And you write that trust between international volunteers and the Ukrainian military was crucial yet precarious. And here's how you describe it. When Doc first rotated to Donetsk, a Portuguese team member whose parents were Ukrainian would translate from Ukrainian to Portuguese, which a Brazilian member would translate to Spanish, which an American member would translate to English. Each link in that chain has since left that country. How much of a language barrier and background impact coordination and trust between this legion of international fighters and Ukrainian troops themselves?
Well, it's an obvious hurdle, but I guess the counterargument to that is I was really surprised by how much they were able to do with extremely minimal verbal communication. I accompanied this team on several missions at night that are difficult to coordinate under any circumstances, but in their case, they were working shoulder to shoulder with Ukrainian soldiers and infantrymen who didn't speak English. They didn't have a translator, and yet, because they had been working together under trying circumstances for a long time already, they were able to maneuver and execute their mission pretty seamlessly, notwithstanding the language barrier.
So, Misha, I want to bring you in here because as you're listening to this, and notwithstanding some of the challenges that these Ukrainian troops had faced, along with the Legion of International Fighters joining them, they managed to retake back territory taken by Russians and continue time and time again to surprise international military experts and at the same time embarrass the Russian military elite as well, who continue to make mistake after mistake. Just this week, we had as many as a few hundred Russian troops, if you were to believe Ukrainian intel, who were killed after a strike in eastern Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry quickly blamed these soldiers by saying, well, they shouldn't have been using their phones, of course, forgetting that the big question as to why they were all stationed together, why they were near a military depot and ammunition depot. All of this is to say there's a lot of criticism that's being leveled against the Russian military, but not Putin yet. Why do you think that is, and what does it say about his control of power at this point?
No, I think he's in control, and he is the only person to take all the decisions, and he is he's not even as a commander-in-chief. He is running the operation, and every important field commander, like general lieutenants, are all reporting to him, bypassing Minister of Defense. So he knows everything, and probably the way how he sees the successes of Russian army are not exactly accurate, and he still believes that it's possible for him to for his army to achieve his goals. And according to my sources, he strongly believes that Russian army is still capable to take Kyiv. That sounds completely insane and the least probable thing to happen, but according to my sources from Moscow, from like close to his inner circle, he still thinks that that's the thing to do.
Well, and it seems that Ukrainians are taking him seriously, whether or not they actually believe that will happen. I know what will also help in them hoping to get more aid from Western countries as well, both financially and militarily. I know both France and Germany now said that they would even be supplying Ukraine with tanks. And the U.S. obviously has taken the lead in providing aid. You have a new piece out in Der Spiegel where you do talk about some other names, perhaps in the wings, who you keep hearing more and more of in terms of a possible success to Vladimir Putin. And one of them stands out, and that is Yevgeny Prigozhin. And for those who don't know him, he has been in charge of that mercenary group around the world, the Wagner Group, that has committed atrocities both in Ukraine and in Africa and other places and countries and continents. And going back to, you know, Trump's early years in the U.S. here, he was the man behind that troll farm, and he was known as Putin's chef. Tell us about him and what it is about him specifically as to why you think you keep hearing his name among your sources.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I named him to be like the person of the year in Russia 2022, or probably the villain of the year, because he is the most scary the most scary new figure in Russian politics, and probably the only political figure that seems to be really independent. He is commanding of his own personal army, private military company Wagner. And that and Wagner is not reporting to the Minister of Defense. That's not a part of the military bureaucracy, and it's fighting on its own. It's fighting near Ukrainian city of Bakhmut, and the chances of Wagner to take Bakhmut seem rather probable. So probably soon we're going to hear of Prigozhin as the only successful war leader on the Russian side. But at the same time, Prigozhin has become very politically important. He's the only guy to openly challenge Ministry of Defense, different Russian governors. He's touring across Russia, recruiting convicts from Russian prisons. So he has that power that is superior to the power of FSB or all other Russian security services. So he can free anyone from prison and take him to his own personal army. So a lot of people in Moscow say that the personal influence of Prigozhin has become that impressive. And so he's got his own clan and many very influential oligarchs, bureaucrats, politicians, like the ideologists of Russian fascism, Dugin, or Konstantin Malafeev, who used to be the sponsor of the invasion to Donbass in 2014, are now allied with Prigozhin. And so probably Prigozhin is going to be the force that could challenge Putin.
So, Misha, quickly, can I just ask you why Putin is allowing for his name to garner as much attention as it has been? He's quashed every single potential opponent in the past. Why has he allowed this?
You know, that's a very good question, and we've got no answer. Probably Putin is is still sure that he's controlling the situation. He likes that kind of rat race, and he thinks that he still controls the situation. And having Prigozhin as a counterpart to Shoigu and Minister of Defense and the Army seems to be the healthy competition for him. But according to my sources, he's not exactly in control of the situation, and so probably he's losing the moment to get his men in his control.
Wow, this is fascinating. And Luke, obviously this has implications on Ukrainian troops on the ground there who are waiting for another assault by Russians. They are saying that that's why they're not going to the negotiating table at this point, because they don't believe that Russia has been inflicted with enough pain to seriously go to the negotiating table. And you've given some wonderful insight into just some of these people from around the world that have come to help the Ukrainian troops. Thank you for your piece. And thank you, Misha, for joining us with your reporting as well. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Putin's war in Ukraine is not the only global political risk set to loom over 2023. A series of international challenges lie ahead as China U-turns on its zero COVID policy and protests in Iran continue. President of Eurasia Group Ian Bremmer talks to Walter Isaacson about what to expect on the world stage this year.
Thank you, Bjarne, and Ian Bremmer, welcome to the show.
Great to be back with you, Walter.
Hey, until I read your latest thing, I was having a happy new year. I was thinking things were going pretty well. COVID's receding. NATO is gathered together pretty well. Russia's not doing that well in Ukraine. And we had a midterm elections that weren't as disruptive to democracy as we thought. And yet I read your letter and you say it's the worst crisis we face in 25 years. Tell me about that.
Well, there's no question that there are a lot of things to be thankful for. The fact that the U.S. democracy and indeed the world's major democracies are not on our top risk list is a very important thing. This is a very strong, flashing, don't panic sign because there is resilience in these institutions. And even when leaders try to do things that are truly disruptive and break the system, plenty of checks and balances that prevent them from doing that. The problem, Walter, is that we are facing a global environment where a small number of individual actors, some of which are aging dictators, some of which are tech bros, there's a little bit of overlap between those two groups, have an extraordinary amount of power. They have no checks and balances. They can make really bad decisions, and they don't get a lot of great expertise in helping them formulate those decisions. Putin, of course, is the one who's made the worst decision of them, literally the worst misjudgment of any major leader on the global stage in decades. And he's going to be paying the consequences for that. And the world is a lot more unstable as a consequence. But it's not just that. It's also Xi Jinping. It's also Iran's supreme leader. And it's also a small number of techno-centric billionaires who also have the ability to make decisions that are deeply disruptive for global democracies without a lot of ability to prevent them from doing that. So that's really where the risks are. Very different than the kind of conversations we were having, say, on January 6th a couple years ago. And yet, in many ways, much more problematic for the world economy, for geopolitics, than what was happening in the nation's capital.
You say we're resilient and that the disruptions are going to happen with people like Putin and all. And yet this week we have seen what really is a weird show in the House of Representatives trying to elect a speaker. Even if it ends up that the dust all settling, doesn't this portend badly for things like having to raise the debt ceiling or having to do normal things that would keep our economy afloat?
It's largely performative. I mean, it is certainly true, Walter, that we haven't had a Speaker of the House vote go beyond the first vote in literally 100 years. So, I mean, congratulations to the GOP for making some history. But we don't need the House in any urgent way to make legislation or pass rules or anything else that requires a speaker. It's very exciting for cable news, don't get me wrong. But for a longer term conversation about the United States and how it is able to act as a leader on the global stage, ensure that its democracy functions, what's happening in the House right now doesn't matter all that much. And there are plenty of ways that you'll get through a debt ceiling in the second half of the year, irrespective of who the Speaker of the House turns out to be.
This week, Vladimir Putin said maybe we'll have a 36-hour ceasefire. Why is it not in everybody's interest to say, let's just have a sustained ceasefire, perhaps guaranteed by an international force, and calm this down?
Well, one, the Ukrainians do not want a ceasefire because so much of their land is illegally occupied by Russia. And we're not just talking about Crimea, which was autonomous under independent Ukraine. We're talking about large amounts of territory that is majority Ukrainian, or at least was until the Russians came in, killed them, and forced them to leave. And that's unacceptable, not just to Ukraine, but to pretty much everybody in NATO. So number one, you can't get Zelensky there after all the war crimes, after, you know, 40% economy contraction over the last 12 months, after millions of refugees. But leaving that aside, there's a much bigger problem, Walter, and that is it is impossible to get Russia back to the status quo ante on February 23rd. Even if you were to have a ceasefire, you're going to have a Ukraine which is massively more armed and capable right there on Russia's borders. You're going to have an expanded NATO with forward deployments, thousands and thousands of troops, much more threatening to Russia than before.
Couldn't we offer some security guarantees as part of a ceasefire?
Oh, sure, but not as part of a ceasefire. The security guarantees, if they were to come, would have to come on the basis of a settlement, not a ceasefire. And we're very, very far from that. So the point is that I can imagine through exhaustion, through an inability to continue to fight, that at some point you could actually get much reduced fighting on the front lines. But Russia will be defeated and humiliated on the global stage. Their life will be so much worse. I mean, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when both sides said, okay, this is stupid, let's take a step back, the Soviets were in the same position they were before the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's what's not possible here. I mean, Russia has made itself into a rogue state where they're never going to be providing gas to the Europeans anymore. Nord Stream 1 and 2 have been sabotaged. We don't know actually by who, but we know that the Europeans have spent massive amounts of money to ensure they'll never have to buy gas from Russia again.
What does it mean to have a rogue Russia?
Well, that's a good question, Walter. What it means, think about a rogue Iran, right? I mean, Iran is the country we think of as a rogue state that's on a lot of our minds. It's a country that doesn't have nuclear weapons, unlike Russia, but they're the principal threat to stability in the Middle East. And that, what's that about? It's about proxy war and terrorist attacks and cyber attacks and espionage and drone attacks and ballistic missile attacks. So a Russia as a rogue state for NATO would be a country that is a perpetual threat for those countries, the way that Iran is a threat to Israel, to Saudi Arabia, to the UAE. That's a very serious problem. That's what happens when the peace dividend is over in Europe and you have a war. Remember, the war that's going on right now with Ukraine is a proxy war with NATO. NATO is fighting Russia. Now, they're fighting Russia using Western intelligence, Western weapons. They don't have soldiers on the ground in Ukraine. They're not doing a no-fly zone, so you don't have American fighter jets knocking Russian jets out of the sky. But from the Russian perspective, this is a war, and it's a war that they're losing. A temporary ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine does nothing to improve Putin's strategic position as a consequence of that, Walter.
One of your prescient predictions last year, and I give you credit for it, was that President Xi Jinping's zero COVID policy wasn't going to work, that there would be protests against it. Well, now tell me, what's next now that he's changed that policy?
Well, first of all, what's next is that Xi Jinping increasingly is running his country the way Putin runs his country. One of the things that we could count on in China, even though it's an authoritarian state, is that they were very thoughtful about long-term strategic policy. They were getting all sorts of expert inputs from technocrats, from hardliners, from pragmatic, people that wanted a more market-oriented economy. Xi Jinping, in his last 10 years, has consolidated authority in historic ways. And he now has more power inside China than any leader since Mao. But in the days of Mao, China didn't have that much impact for the global economy or for global political institutions or for national security, for that matter. Now they do. And the fact that Xi Jinping decided literally on a dime to go from the most locked down COVID policy to the least and isn't providing any data, any transparency on the numbers of cases, the numbers of deaths, or any new variants that might be popping up from what is right now the global epicenter of the COVID pandemic in China, means that there are all sorts of dangers that emanate from China on the pandemic front. I wish it was only that. But of course, when you have a leader with that much power that can make that kind of a decision on COVID, you're going to see decisions like that made in the global economy as well, in technology issues, on national security. And as much as the U.S.-China relationship is vastly more stable than the U.S.-Russia relationship, and both leaders want it to remain so, there is going to be a greater level of decoupling by Western multinationals away from China because of that extraordinary uncertainty, because they're not getting the data out of China's economy, because they don't understand what might happen in a week, in a month, in 3 months' time.
Do you mean that American corporations, whether it be Apple or Tesla and others, are going to have to pull out of China?
I don't think they're going to have to pull out of China at all. I think there are very few corporations that will be required to pull out of China. There are, of course, export controls that the United States has started levying in China back last October on advanced semiconductors that are seen as dual use for both the economy and for military purposes. If you were doing business in that sector, you can't do that business in China anymore. Fair enough. And if you're Google or Facebook and you wanted to do business with all of your data acquisition and search and social media, China won't let you in. Most corporations can still do any business they want to do in China. The point is that increasingly that business looks more dangerous. It looks more risky. So they don't want to have to pay so much for it. That's why Apple is increasingly moving a lot of its production away from China. They're not being forced to do it legally by the United States. They're just concerned about what the future portends inside the Chinese economy with the Xi Jinping that they don't have a very good read on. They could make sudden, very different decisions about the technology sector or others. And so Apple's moving more to Vietnam and to other places around the world. I think a lot of major U.S. corporations are increasingly going to look to friendshore, to inshore, as opposed to have so much of their global production inside China.
Why is there such a lack of global leadership these days?
I think there are a lot of reasons for that. One is because there's a feeling in many populations that their leaders ignored their own working and middle classes. That has led to a my country first perspective. It's not just America first under Trump. Biden's U.S. foreign policy for an American middle class is also a functional understanding that if we're not getting the message through to Main Street in the United States, we don't want to be involved in wars around the world. Now, Ukraine has been the exception. And Walter, we have seen a lot of leadership from the United States on Ukraine, not just militarily, but diplomatically and economically. It's made the G7 stronger. It's made NATO stronger. But your question even fits there, because the developing world looks at the West and says, you only care about Ukraine because it's a bunch of white people in Europe. If that was happening in Ethiopia or the DRC or Yemen, you wouldn't say boo. So why are we going to take the food prices, fertilizer, and energy prices on the chin? Why should we support your sanctions and your votes when you don't care about us? And that also makes it harder to have global leadership when a majority of the world's 8 billion people don't trust that the United States, Japan, Germany, other wealthy countries are going to lift a finger for them. You know, we're called donor countries, the wealthy democracies in the world. And yet, if you're sitting in a country like India or in sub-Saharan African countries, you think that you're the ones that are doing the donating. It's your human capital and labor. It's your resources that are getting exploited. And yet you're the charity cases in the world. They really angers them. And that's another reason why we have a harder time with global leadership right now.
How do you see the protests in Iran playing out?
The protests in Iran are clearly there's no useful response by the Iranian government. It's months now. The only thing they've said is more repression. They're not going to in any way take their demands on board. You're not looking at regime change in the near future. The numbers of people that are demonstrating still comparatively small, even though it's all over the country. And there are no particular leaders of this opposition. It's been really grassroots from the young people, particularly women, all over the country. But it comes at the same time that the Iranians are nearing breakout nuclear capability, and there's no possibility of going back to a nuclear deal. The Americans would never provide that given what they're doing to their people on the ground, and the Iranians won't take the risk to compromise. And then, as we mentioned before, the Iranians are doing the most to provide support for Russia right now in this war. So you put all of that together with a new Israeli right-wing government led by Netanyahu, the potential for military confrontation in the Middle East has actually gone up quite a bit.
Let me go back to that, the fact that Iran will get some form of nuclear weaponry soon. What does that mean? What do we do? What should we do?
Well, you know, it's not, it's certainly not guaranteed that they will acquire nuclear weapons. There are major risks to Iran's own national security if they were to either make those moves and it was found out or announced that they were going to make those moves. But part of the problem is that where they're stockpiling and doing their advanced, high grade uranium enrichment right now is buried deep under a mountain, and Israeli national security advisors will tell you that they don't have credible military options to disrupt or destroy that nuclear capability. It's not like 10, 20 years ago. So you want to put pressure on them? Yes. You want to prevent them from going nuclear? Yes. But at the same time, the Americans wanted to prevent Pakistan from going nuclear, India from going nuclear. We had sanctions on those countries for years as a consequence.
Well, wait, are you saying that Iran might go nuclear and we would just let it happen?
I'm saying Iran might go nuclear. We would be extremely angry about it. I'm sure we'd put more sanctions on. And ultimately, I suspect we'd learn to live with it. And I'm not happy about that at all. But we've done that with North Korea. I mean, our policy is denuclearization. It is unacceptable for North Korea to have nuclear weapons, but it's a little like the Princess Bride. Unacceptable may not mean what we think it means.
We're now at the second anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. And in a weird way, we've seen its echoes even in the dysfunction in the House of Representatives this week. To what extent do you think we have recovered or can recover from that threat to our democracy?
I think we have recovered from that specific threat to our democracy. I think that after January 6th, there was a tail risk, small but real and growing, that the U.S. could be heading for a constitutional crisis in the presidential election in 2024. So Trump, for example, becomes the Republican nominee. It's a close election, say he loses, but you have people in positions of power overseeing state elections, secretaries of state, governors that decide that they're gonna help him try to steal the election. He can't overturn it, but he can break it. I think that the potential of that happening in 2024 is now virtually zero. Because not because Democrats were able to hold the Senate, or because there wasn't a red wave. No, rather because truly incompetent people running for some core positions that would oversee state elections, those people lost. And so you just don't have people in positions of power that are prepared to try to steal or break the election. Remember, when Trump tried to do that after January 6th, and in the run-up to January 6th, when he was calling Republican Party members in Georgia and Arizona, find me some votes. I want to steal this election. That's basically what he did. We found that in the January 6th committee investigations. Republican Party members, rank and file, said no. And they said no because fundamentally they may be conservative, they may be Republican, doesn't matter. They're American. And first and foremost, they believe in rule of law, just like the police do, just like the military does. And it turns out that that really matters in a country like the United States. The U.S. was tested and the U.S. Responded. And I think at least in the near term, plenty of deep structural challenges with democracy in the United States that we could address on many, many shows in the future. But specifically to answer your question on January 6th, we do not face a proximate crisis of democracy in this country.
Ian Bremmer, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Walter.
Fascinating look at geopolitical hotspots in 2023, including here in the U.S. And finally, this week, Catholics around the world bid farewell to Pope Benedict XVI, who was laid to rest on Thursday at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Pope Francis presided over the funeral of his predecessor, the first time that has ever happened. Benedict's death also marked the end of an era that had not one, but two living popes. That unusual situation was immortalized in the 2019 Netflix movie, The Two Popes, which was inspired by true events. Here's a clip from the trailer.
The grand doors have slammed shut and will remain so until the next pope has been chosen.
From that balcony up there.
Nothing is static in nature, not even God.
Where should we find him if he's always moving?
On the journey?
Oh, perhaps we'll find God over there. On the journey, I'll introduce you to him.
Cantare!
King Hook must remember that you are not God. You're only human.
Anthony Hopkins plays Pope Benedict, and Jonathan Pryce stars as the soon-to-be-elected Pope Francis. So let's take a look back at part of Christiane's interview with Pryce about the film.
So The Two Popes is getting a huge amount of attention and critical review, very good critical acclaim. I've watched it. It's amazing. I just want to know, were you born to play this part? I mean, you look identical to Pope Francis.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not what I see when I look in the mirror. I feel more Brad Pitt than Pope. Yeah, the day he was declared Pope was the internet was full of images of the two of us, either me or High Sparrow compared to the Pope. And it seemed a certain inevitability that if there ever was to be a film about him, that I would play him.
Did you have any inkling that there might be, and that this might actually happen and happen in this way? Because, the vehicle is so compelling. Essentially, tight shots of you and Anthony Hopkins playing two living popes and really mostly just a discussion between you. An important one, but it's not action and adventure and intrigue and, Vatican high crimes and skullduggery.
Well, it is about all of those things, high crimes and skullduggery. It's also about faith and about forgiveness and compassion. And when you read it you get the screenplay sent to you, and it seems a very dry read. It's two men of the church, two old men of the church, having a debate and an argument, and there are flashbacks to Bergoglio's life in Buenos Aires. When you know that it's going to be directed by Fernando Moraes, who has a wonderful film that is one of my favorite all-time favorite films, City of God, there's going to be a different kind of energy to it. It wasn't going to be a hagiography. It was going to have some life and vitality and have a political point of view as well as a religious point of view.
Okay, so let's break that down, because, again, you embody Pope Francis in a way that's just, it's eerie, really. And you start to really believe that Anthony Hopkins is the spitting image of Pope Benedict. And the two of you are having these discussions. And let's just talk first about the politics. Explain to me where the politics are for you and for the two popes.
Yeah, well, I'm not religious. When I was a child, I was brought up in the Welsh Presbyterian Church. I used to go to chapel. And like many teenagers, moved away from the church. And not being a Catholic, I'd never really taken much notice of any popes. I was aware of them to a certain extent, but Pope Francis was the first pope that I began to listen to, because not only was on he was on our TV screens and our newspapers were full of him, I felt he was talking to me, and he was talking to me about political issues and about the economy, about the inequality in the world. Talking about the environment, talking about issues that me and millions like me want to hear our leaders talk about. So I was drawn to him because of these issues, less to do with the church.
And Bergoglio in the film talks a lot about walls. Walls become a very important motif through the film. Just describe for us the politics of the wall and what the film was saying about that.
Well, it's a very simple image, and it's an image that, as you say, comes in towards the end of the film, where everything they've been talking about, especially what Francis has been talking about, is we open it up to see these images in the rest of the world. And he was one of the first person who was talking about building bridges and not walls. And the you know, the irony is that all these walls are going up of people want to build walls in America, in Eastern Europe. And we need to break these walls down. We need to reach out to people. We need to have a civilized debate. And what this film shows rather wonderfully is that we can debate these issues. Two men with very different views of the church and about society in general, but they can talk about them, and we need to talk about them.
Jonathan Price, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's nice to talk to you again. Thanks.
You too.
Building bridges, not walls. Well, we certainly need more of that. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. It's great to be back with you. Thanks so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.